So I wanted to talk about physics and how it relates to our understanding of the self, of consciousness. And there's so much that one can cover, particularly in this field or the pillar of science. Now, each of these pillars interrelates with all the other ones, so it is hard to talk exclusively on science without going into philosophy and also inevitably mysticism, which is what we really want to know about. So normally when we think of science, we probably relate to what we know as modern materialistic science. And this is those experiments of the five senses, those things, the five physical senses that we all know about, sight, hearing, taste, touch and smell. And the pure materialist is concerned with proving or disproving things based on what they can see with these five senses. And as a result, often the materialist and the skeptic go hand in hand. So, once the proof develops its concepts based on the five physical senses, not regarding all the other inner senses that we can have. But science itself is something that's really important in the spiritual studies. So why? So science and scientific knowledge it's about acquiring knowledge or information. It's about verifying things for ourselves. So going beyond a mere belief. So when a scientist does an experiment, they have a hypothesis, so you could say a belief in something, and they go and they test it. They test the validity of their hypothesis. And so they try and prove. My experience in the science realm is that often we find our theories are disproven. But at least it's, we've tried to get that knowledge verified for ourselves. So this idea of experimenting, it's really about doing. It's about experience things for ourselves. And we know in the Gnostic studies that the Gnostic is one that wants to experience it directly, doesn't want to just have a belief or to just trust what someone else says about life and the mysteries of life. So it's really about going, doing things, doing the practices and learning directly. So the pillar of science or the scientific method helps us to approach the esoteric world in a way that's didactic. So there's like a process and in a way that is balanced. So I personally have always been a fan of the pillar of science. So both materialistically and esoterically. So the esoteric sciences are also, worthy of discovering. And as any true seeker inevitably will be interested in the scientific discoveries because, as I said, it's about doing and verifying for ourselves. So on today's show, as I mentioned, we're going to study physics, both the classical and quantum discoveries that have been made by past scientists, and then how these discoveries relate to our understanding of our consciousness and then ultimately of our being. Now, we had a couple of segments on entropy last year, so you can find that in the archives on the website, gnosticwaves.com. And these talks were great. They're very, there was an element of going through the law of entropy, which is a scientific principle, and was explaining one of the laws of thermodynamics and how we can work to overcome this tendency to chaos, which is very simply put, how entropy works. And to do that, we need to work to ask for help from higher forces that are within us, so higher intelligences like our inner being. So nowadays, it seems that people, find it easier to separate science and discovering from spirituality. Seems like it's difficult for people to reconcile this, that they can't coexist together conceptually. When I was doing research for this talk tonight, I discovered that many scientists that have existed have also been very spiritual people and have had religious beliefs. So science and religion can exist and should coexist, really, to have a balanced approach. And I especially think that with so many unknown variables in life, it seems like we're shooting ourselves in the foot if we only accept things that are proven to be true by the five senses and rejecting everything else until proven, when there's so much that exists that can't be measured but we know to be true, or can't be visibly seen but is known to be true and to exist. But anyway, that's my own personal belief there. So over the course of the science segments on the program, I would like to review different scientists and their theories and how they relate to the esoteric or spiritual reality. So just to clarify some terms, both esoteric and spiritual more or less refer to the same thing. But esoteric is a word maybe that people are more open to and may attract less resistance from a non-believer, because esoteric is often used to describe anything unknown, particularly in the scientific realms, but also in the spiritual realms. Okay, so in my research for these talks, it started to become clear that the line between what we know and what we postulate to be true is very faint. So we can have many theories, but from our theories and what is truth is, it's a bit grey. So even scientists that do these discoveries, they struggle, they compete, they argue with one another about their research and whose research or whose theory is more accurate and, the better theory or the better hypothesis, the more superior one. So really, at the end of the day, the egos are still present, even if it's discovery of something that will revolutionize modern medicine. It won't be about the discovery itself, it'll be about who discovered it, who was the first to discover it, and then consequently how much money they'll make from that discovery. This is sort of what it comes down to these days, and that natural search or curiosity for knowledge and truth appears to be second to who, or our pride, or who, can discover these things first. But this is a reflection of the age we're living in at the moment. So when I studied at university, we had this particular assignment, and I studied science, where we had to pick another researcher's journal article and critique it, essentially to find its flaws. So, I did the assignment at the time. You might ask why we had to do this. Firstly, to show how easily results can be misrepresented or enhanced to favour a particular hypothesis. So I think the slang term is how to fudge results. But secondly, to develop the capacity to critique another's work. So in a way, it encourages scepticism, and this can go both ways, because we need a little bit of scepticism, especially in this information age where there's so much information out there on the internet. But when we question things and critique them, it encourages us to look beyond what is just presented to us so we can develop some discernment, not just accepting things as they are. So likewise, in any philosophy or in any belief system, then we should be encouraged to do the same, to critique, but without like an angry skepticism, just with a skepticism that is questioning, but not to put down or to discredit in a negative way. So there's a difference there if we're subtle enough to perceive it. All right, so let's get into the science. So we have classical physics and we have quantum physics. And I'll refer to them as mechanics because the terms are interchangeable, physics and the mechanics. I like mechanics because we are a mechanical being. We talk about our psychology is mostly mechanical until we work to wake up. So understanding the mechanics of nature is what we really want to learn about so we can free ourselves from it. So classical physics is concerned with a set of physical laws that describe the motion of bodies that are under the influence of a system of forces. So any large body, like how we move, how the planets move and orbit, when we throw a ball, the laws that determine what happens to that ball, how far it goes, how high it goes, where it drops, that the fact that it does drop eventually and not just continue on into space, which if you threw a ball into space, it would just continue going. So these classical mechanics are most notably related to Sir Isaac Newton's discoveries and his laws or formulas that he developed to measure the different forces that exist physically. So every object, so his laws, just to like very quickly state, he had three main laws, and one of them was every object in a state of uniform motion tends to remain in that state of motion unless an external force is applied. The second one, the relationship between an object's mass, acceleration, and the applied force. So there's just a formula there. And then for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. And that's, I think of all the laws, that's the one that's most commonly known, the one that is definitely referred to a lot in the esoteric studies, particularly because it helps us to understand karma. So when I'm trying to explain karma to people, cause and effect, that everything we do, everything we say, everything we think has an effect, I simply refer to that law, which is very easily proven in the classical physics. And I postulate if it exists on the physical level, why can't it exist on the mental level and also in the things that we say? Anyway, that's a bit of an aside there. So classical mechanics use common sense notions of how matter and forces exist and how they interact together. So I give the example of the famous story of Newton sitting under a tree, observing the apple falling from the tree. And sometimes people say that the apple hit him on the head, and it's not known whether that exactly happened, but at the very least, he observes this apple falling and, he has a light bulb moment, and then the result is the explanation of gravity and all the other formulas that were derived from that realization. So, in essence, a combination of Newton's law of motion and gravitation provide the fullest and most accurate description of classical mechanics. Okay, so Isaac Newton was quite an interesting fellow in my research, I discovered. And he was around from the 1643 to 1727. So he was a scientist, physician, mathematician. But back in those days, scientists were also known as natural philosophers. And I think that's really interesting because those are times when it was more common that people that were scientists were also philosophers, were also artists, and into mysticism or spirituality. So they were more integrated in their knowledge, their approach to knowledge, whilst nowadays they're so distinct and they don't really relate to each other. So that nowadays scientists are just scientists, and philosophers are just philosophers, and artists are just, you know, do their art. But it's rare to find that they are all integrated together. So Newton was a fellow of the College of Cambridge. And at that time, anyone that was a fellow of this school or of the Oxford School were required to take holy orders and become an ordained Anglican priest. And the interesting thing with Newton was that he was a Christian. Well, he had to be a Christian to be accepted as a fellow of the College of Cambridge. But he was quite an unorthodox Christian in his methods, and he found a way around this rule. So he actually didn't become ordained, and for whatever reason, that meant he could focus more on his science. So most people know him as like one of the founders of classical physics. But he also was quite theological, so he studied Bible scriptures, he studied proportions in architecture, particularly the Temple of Solomon, and he was trying to find hidden information in the actual dimensions of the structure of the temple. And also he was into the alchemy, study of the alchemy, and apparently had the biggest collection of alchemy books of that time. And a lot of his works were actually destroyed in a fire in his laboratory. So there's stuff that survived and there's stuff that didn't survive. But basically he was into the esoteric realm, and he was also known to associate with people connected to esoteric societies, secret societies, notably with the Rosicrucians. Although there was no evidence that he himself was a Rosicrucian, his works certainly reflected that he was in agreement with these esoteric or occult teachings, particularly with the alchemy. And the study of alchemy in itself is very interesting. We in Gnosis understand that in the science of alchemy is encoded or is symbolic of techniques of how to transform ourselves, both psychologically, spiritually, and physically. And alchemy as an occult science goes far deeper than the what is presented as the creating gold from lead, which is what most people believe it to be, and the search for, you know, the philosopher's stone that was able to help to create the gold. But in the Gnostic studies and the esoteric studies, we know that these are allegories for our own inner spiritual revolution or transformation. So one of Newton's colleagues wrote about him that Newton was not the first of the Age of Reason. He was the last of the magicians. So definitely worth looking at Newton and his esoteric studies, discoveries in another program. But just before we go to a music break, just to sum up that the classical mechanics explains how and why physical objects move and the laws that govern this. And thought I would start there before talking about the quantum mechanics. But we'll just take a break. I've chosen a piece from a CD, Chopin Waltzes Chazeros Preludes, and it's Chopin Prelude number 24 in D minor. So we'll be back in a short while. And you're back on the Gnostic Waves. That was a short but fine piece of music composed by Chopin. And I'm talking on the topic of physics, particularly quantum physics, quantum mechanics. in this part of the show. And quantum mechanics is really fascinating and probably more relevant or applicable in understanding ourselves and consciousness. Now, the foundations of quantum mechanics were established during the first half of the 20th century by Max Planck, Niels Bohr, Albert Einstein, and amongst others, many others, but they're sort of the most famous names. So whilst classical mechanics defines the laws of larger, more tangible objects, a quantum mechanics concerns with the processes of atoms and photons, so things that we can't really see but happen at the molecular, submolecular level. So I'll just list a couple of theories that you may have heard of. So we have the uncertainty principle. And this principle basically describes that when measuring a particle, like an electron or a photon of light, its position and its momentum or its speed cannot be measured at the same time. So we can measure one, but not the other. So we have to pick which one. And for some reason, they both can't be measured at the same time. So that's the uncertainty principle. And there's also something called the observer effect. And this is that the measurements of certain systems cannot be made without affecting the system itself. And this is a finding that has baffled most physicists, and some scientists just completely overlook this law because it's so baffling. But it's something that is actually quite very interesting, and just shows that things that happen on the physical level assume to happen at the atomic level, but no, things happen differently. And so the conflict between classical and quantum mechanics is one that just has not yet been unified to you know, theorists and physicists. And it's interesting because there's certain scientists, like particularly Albert Einstein, that wanted to create a theory of everything. So that's like the holy grail of the scientists or the physicists, to make a formula that explains everything, and that everything fits, all the observations and phenomena of nature fit into that formula. And I was reading on the internet, and that even Stephen Hawking says that such a formula is not even possible. So it's funny how we just want to, it's like we just want to characterize things and identify them, and it's funny because it's sort of like another way we want to control nature. We want to be one up on nature, and just to have a theory that explains everything. But perhaps we're not designed to do that. So I wanted to play a clip, and this is from a movie, a documentary, and I'll explain the documentary a bit after the clip. But it's basically, it's used as a tool to explain the different experiments that show what happens in classical mechanical experiments compared to the quantum level, and how it's different. So some people may have heard this before. I'll just run the track, and then I can talk a bit about it and what it means. Okay, so that was just a little snippet from the documentary called What the Bleep Do We Know Down the Rabbit Hole? So it's the sequel to that film. And I wanted to play it, even though in the movie there's a visual, so it makes it easier to understand the experiment that happened, and that is the most famous experiment that shows the difference between classical physics and quantum physics, and it's something that's pretty extraordinary. So what is essentially happening is there is a wave function that is collapsing. And this describes the change from having many possible states, quantum states, to conforming to one state only. So what it's saying is that an electron, behaves like a wave. It can be in many positions at once, but once it's been measured or observed, as they term it, then it actually picks one formation or one state and sticks to that. And so, although this collapse, you could say, is historically thought to be caused by a measurement only, and thus dependent on the role of the observer in preparing the experiment, the collapses can occur whenever quantum systems interact. So, for example, collisions between particles or even spontaneously, so like radioactive decay. And so maybe this is a bit over the head, but it's basically implying, or at least in this documentary, that we as observers have a significant effect on what we see in reality. And this is what they are trying to show in this documentary. But I wanted to add that there is, when you read on the internet about this documentary, there is a bit of skepticism. They say a bit of oversimplification of the science, and then some people have reported that observing with an instrument is one thing, but we as observers are, it's a big jump from a measuring tool to us as observers, and that it probably wouldn't apply to us and our consciousness. But it's I leave it up to you to reflect on, to accept or reject. But it's definitely something that, to me, it's not such a big stretch of the imagination to think this is true. Especially because I think about the process of how we receive impressions, in that, at school you learn that to see things you need light. So the light that bounces off an object, and the light absorbs the energy of its frequency, and it reflects energy that's not. So when we see something that is a particular color, like red, we know that that object is, you could say, not red. It's absorbing everything, every other color, and it's rejecting, or it's reflecting off the color that we see. So that in itself is really interesting, isn't it? So then that reflection enters into our eyes, and it enters in upside down, and then our eye inverts it the right way up. So it's just really interesting to understand the actual science of how we receive impressions. And I have given this example before, if we're regular listeners to this show, just because it's something that is fascinating. So this process of seeing is a lot more complex than I have said. But, the other thing I wanted to mention was the skeptical views of things. Like, this documentary was actually made by people of a particular spiritual school called the Ramph School of Enlightenment. And I don't know much of this school. I have looked on the internet to read some things. I found some stuff that wasn't so nice. I don't know what the school is about, really. The documentary is pretty factual. It's got lots of information. It's got lots of people that they interview talking about this idea of quantum mechanics and how our consciousness is the observer, and therefore by the fact that we look at things and focus on things, we like take what is like an infinite possibility of scenarios or states, and then we localize it or collapse and have one sort of outlook or determination of what we see. And it's interesting because there's the sequel to the film, which I took that clip from, and then the sequel also, they provide the interviews of all the people that they have interviewed. And it's interesting because then you can see the interviews that haven't been edited. Well, I'm sure they were still edited. But you can see that they've taken bits here, bits there to help prove their perspective or their what they think is relevant, useful to communicate, probably reflective of this the School of Enlightenment. There's lots of really good stuff there. It relates to some the teachings of the Gnostic teachings as well. But it's funny how there's the skeptics. There's always a skeptic. No matter what you're trying to prove or disprove, there's always someone out there that is going to disagree and try to pull it to pieces. And that's pretty universal for everything. So not just spiritual topics, but anyone that has a scientific discovery, you can be sure there's someone there on the other side of the world that is ready to pull it to pieces. And I mentioned that before in that, you know, the critiquing of other people's work and how with the ego still present, it's always, it can, the real purpose of science and discovery can get lost. So I just wanted to mention that. There's always skeptics out there, and particularly with the internet, you know, anyone can have an opinion on anything. And, why not? I'm not saying we shouldn't have an opinion. It's just that we need to have that discernment, and that's why it's more important to be able to test and do these experiments, reflect on these things ourselves to determine if we are accepting that this theory, this ideology is actually something that can help us in our life. From my point of view, if it's something that gives us strength to overcome our difficulties, to overcome our negative circumstances, problems, stresses, then it's very welcome. So back to the actual teaching here. So saying basically that whatever our consciousness observes has a powerful impact on our reality, the circumstances that we create and how we perceive events in life. So in the Gnostic teachings, we learn that we are processing impressions of life all the time, but mainly we do it through the conditioning of our personality. And our personality is shaped from when we're born. It's most particularly set up by the age of 7. So the first 7 years are quite critical in developing our personality. And it's shaped by our family, our friends, our culture, and our media, or the media that exists. And that's just to name a few of the influences of our personality. So this is how we receive the impressions of life, not ordinarily. So we also are creating and validating concepts through memories that we have, through past traumas or even, you know, good events, and the experiences that we have in life. So in the same way, how we are receiving impressions, you know, in a very mechanical way. So we work to transform impressions so that they don't get misfiled in our psyche. So say, for example, we've got a particular trauma associated with something, then we need to understand the impressions that feed that and to transform them as a way to start to eliminate the food of that trauma or of that ego that's become a bit stuck or fixated, blocked in our psychology. So our consciousness, when it's awake, when it's active, it is able to focus and to perceive reality in a more accurate, more truthful way. And so it's something that hopefully we can all reflect on and to get something that we can apply in our life. All right, so we'll go to another short music break and then we'll go to the third part of the show. Okay, we're back. I've had to cut that track short. A piece from Chopin, Prelude number 15 in D flat. Okay, so let's get ready to do a meditation practice. All this talk of experimenting, doing, and it's important. We really want to experience the mysteries, truth directly, that we have time to reflect on the information that we receive. Allowing our consciousness that already knows truth, providing the space within ourself, within our heart, within our mind, for that consciousness to express itself, to teach us. To allow that consciousness to be the real observer. In this practice tonight, I would like to work with this idea that everything that we see is not just as we see it. That when we close our eyes, the memory of everything we perceive with our eyes actually just dissolves, merges into a big mass of wave-like energy. So if we haven't already, relaxing the body, closing the eyes, and taking a few deep breaths, moving the oxygen and the prana throughout the body, trying to focus on something like the breath or the beating of the heart to to not get too involved in the mind. If we've been at work all day, it's going to be considerably harder. If we haven't been in a state of self-remembering, it is going to be harder to relax and let go. But nevertheless, we still try. So with our eyes firmly shut, let's imagine that everything that exists in the room as we perceived it with our eyes open does not exist in that way. And ultimately doesn't. With our eyes closed, we are not receiving any of the photons of light to process as images. The room does not exist the same way, objectively. It is purely our subjective processing of the room that we see. So just going beyond the same thing with our body, our physical body. We perceive it in a certain way, letting go of that identification, that model of how we perceive the body. In a way, we are disintegrating the form of the body. And then we work to de-identify with our thoughts, the thoughts of the self, the thoughts of what we're going to do after the practice, after the show. This dissolves away to imagining that our heart, the beating of the heart, these vibrations spread out unperturbed, limitless, in all directions. We no longer restricted to what we perceive as us, our body, of this room, going beyond these limitations. And then we can imagine in infinite possibilities that we are existing, we are being in a universe, a cosmos of many different layers, dimensions, and that there is so much we don't know. And beyond our capacity to understand, to characterize, to formalize, anything is possible. Reflecting on infinite possibility. And we'll end this practice there. This show is almost over. Hopefully we've felt, brought back that capacity of amazement of life, of who we are, of the part that we are in this cosmos, and that things are beyond our own conceptual limitations. So thank you for joining me this evening. Hope you got something from the program and can join me next week on starting on the introduction to astrology. So once a month we'll be going through the different zodiac signs, starting with Aries, and I know we don't have much time for Aries, but we'll just slip it in. So yeah, hope you can join me, and so will be joining me on the show next week. Gnostic instructor from Newcastle. So yes, we'll see you then. Hope you have a good evening and a good week.